So we're back.
You pressed record.
Yeah.
Oh, calm.
We're back. We're back with another episode of Filthy Fellas.
I said Filthy Fellas, you know.
Nah, I'm just joking. I always start with some kind of joke. Nah, but actually, we're not back. We're forward. I don't believe in going back.
It's wow. Just,
we're always moving forward. Mm. So we're forward with another episode.
Mm. Stay woke.
Today. So yeah, actually, there's been some changes. So I'm going to address the audience real quick. There's been some changes, some positive changes as well. So we have a new co-host.
Come on.
Voltaire.
Yes,
show.
Yes.
Cheese.
No, saying. Come on.
Yeah, so we've got Voltaire. And today we've got an amazing guest. I don't know how to pronounce your name properly. Sorry, your surname properly. So
Sean Flores.
Flores.
Yeah, Spanish.
Hear that.
What's the origins of
well,
that name?
Spanish, so Latin America technically.
Okay, cool, man.
Or like South that. America, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, you know what? I'm going to like, obviously I've read your bio.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to try shooting a little bit. Not a little bit, quite a bit actually. So,
it's all right, man. Go ahead.
You're
man.
An advocate for mental health.
Yeah.
Well-being, resilience. You're a public speaker. And you spread a really positive message out there. And you have actually got like, to me when I read it and some of the content that I've seen that you've made, you've got like a really powerful message or you've got a lot of powerful stories. And I think a lot of the times people like, look at people spreading some of the message and say, what's the point? But actually it makes a big difference. Like I think stories like yours and advocating for powerful messages out there is really important. Is there anything else that you want to add to who you are?
I suppose, yeah, I suppose that eclipses everything that I am now at the moment.
Season it.
I think I want to go on to become a therapist at some point. I think that's the next goal. It's the next plan. I want that to be my last, I want that to be the last profession I ever do. I almost want to do that for the rest of my life. So now I'm just trying to figure out how to get into that profession, trying to understand whether I can work for the NHS or go private. But I think, especially in our community, man, I think men and especially a lot of black and ethnic men, we need places to be able to be free, but to also practice good masculinity. I don't think masculinity in itself is toxic, which I think is a conversation that too many people are having nowadays. I think there's healthy elements, but yeah, that's basically what I want to do.
Mm. I like that, my guy. What would you class as freedom? You said you want black men to feel free. What would you class as?
Well, I think it's the autonomy to choose your life, your autonomy to choose your destiny, to be the captain of your ship and to be able to set sail where you want to go.
I like that.
Ideally. And to have, I think also to have good enough economic empowerment. I think quite often people don't realise that whilst some people quote unquote are free, there's people with degrees out there, there's people that have all the qualifications but they're still in jail because they're struggling to have any sort of economic empowerment. So these are some of the things that I really would like to change. And I think that would mean for me be true freedom for especially my community.
So the other thing I was going to say, so there's this like new kind of like theory, or it's not that much of a theory anymore. It's coming. There's a new thing coming out, which is around, they say that rather than race in terms of how people struggle, it's actually to do with like socioeconomic backgrounds. So like people from, you know, different races can be growing up in the same sort of background, like economically, and they might struggle just as much. And it kind of takes the whole thing of like particular race away as well. Well, what do you think about that?
I think it's an interesting argument. And I think I do agree that in some instances, in the UK especially, class has even more of a barrier compared to race. But I do also think, I'm not sure whether I agree with it entirely, but I think when you're black compared to many other races, your colour doesn't always necessarily hold you back. Like, for example, you know, you're not from Britain, quote unquote. Some people would still discriminate against you. But I think it's quite hard to quantify these things unless you put them out into data. But no, I think class has a massive, big part to play in the UK. And I think we see it every day with things you can only really access via class, you know, certain sports, certain environments, how you learn certain parts of culture and cultural capital. A lot of my friend who went to boarding school, this is something we speak about quite often. He said going to boarding school, it gave him a very different experience than what it would have given him when he'd gone to state school. He said in state school, they teach you to be part of the machine, whereas in boarding school, they teach you to create solutions to problems. And if that doesn't have anything to do with class, I don't know what is, but class is obviously money. But I think there's also a racial element definitely tied in with that as well, for sure. But I do think it's a very interesting argument.
I feel like I disagree on that point, can't lie. The original point that you made earlier about class and race, because I feel like, yeah, even though we may still be the same class, I'm not saying that my race necessarily will hold me back, but it would never push me forward. No, that never is wrong. It would rarely push me forward. So I feel like it's a battle that we're always facing. Yeah, that's my personal view on it. But I'm glad to see that such a shining, you have such a shining energy, even though you said you come here and you're a bit down with it. Your energy is kind of, it's coming through. You see that?
No, I mean, we can feel it still.
I'm trying, man. I'm trying a little bit ill, but no, I'm grateful. I think conversations are very important in society, man. I think we live in a time now where if people disagree with people now, they just want to shut them down. They don't want to have conversations, which I think speaks a lot about social media, speaks a lot about how we're not exposed to people with different viewpoints, and how in society we really and truly, we're creating more and more identity politics that's dividing us more and more. I think humans inevitably, we're tribal animals, right? And I think we've got to give credit to humanity for being able to create such cohesion, but within that cohesion there's a lot more division now arising more than ever before. Like I think, for example, even if you do believe that class has more of an impact on race, you're allowed to believe that, right? And I'm allowed to listen to that even if I don't agree with that, and I'll go away and I'll do my research, and if I find information that combats my worldview, it's important for me to take that information on. Whereas now, so many people, you show them different parts of evidence and they just go, nah, I don't want to hear it. I just don't want to believe it. So this is why I think conversations are important, as long as you're open-minded and you're willing to actually discuss.
Yeah, do you know what's interesting? Just going back to that point I was making earlier. Oh, it's not a point that I'm making, I'm just bringing information to light. So for me, I don't necessarily believe that. I think personally, as an individual, I try not to attach myself to ideologies or like theories and all of that stuff. I like to explore different things and try and understand things. But there's, so I was watching, do you guys know who Abba and Preach is?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was watching a video that they reviewed, but I don't know what channel that was from, so I can't give you the name of the channel. But there was like an experiment they've done. I think they got like 7 or 8 black guys in a room and they blindfolded all of them. And there was this one white guy in a room, and obviously he didn't have a blindfold, so you knew. Like, but basically the whole point of the game was for them to guess who the white person was.
I suppose it's Jubilee. I feel like it's it Jubilee
probably,
video.
It was probably Jubilee does a lot of those type of videos, so probably is them.
Interesting.
So what's really interesting towards the end, so basically no one ended up guessing the right person, like who the white person was actually. But what was really interesting, and Abba and Preach were breaking it down, talking about social economic backgrounds and all of that stuff. But this white guy, basically, he got adopted by a black family when he was a baby, and he grew up in a neighborhood. So that kind of highlighted that actually, regardless of his skin color, the neighborhood he was growing up in, that's what influenced, like, you know, his experience, rather than, you know what I'm saying? So I think there's a lot of different elements. I think race definitely does play a part. But you know, I think there's other elements that people miss or don't explore enough.
So then that would be culture. I think culture is a really big part to play. And one of my friends, she also was adopted by a black family, and she is half white, half Chinese, but she feels more at home amongst other black people. Whereas I'm not sure if she feels at home amongst other Chinese people. I don't want to speak for her, but this is as much of her story that I know. But culture has a massive part to play. Caribbean culture is very different to African culture. You've got Latino black culture is very different to other parts of culture. And I think growing up, especially in the Western world, we've got a bubble mentality. You know, a lot of what we grow up with, we're exposed to certain ideas, but whereas you go to other parts of the world, they don't have the access to information that we have. So I think culture says a lot.
Yeah, and there's a lot. And I think we're in a stage now, especially in London, I don't know about other parts of the world because I live here, but there's a lot of subcultures. So, you know, I think someone made a really interesting point before. I was talking to someone on the podcast and she was saying that actually you can have people from Nigeria who moved to America and then moved to London. But even though they have that main culture, the Nigerian culture from back from Nigeria, but they still create subcultures based on where they're living. And I found that really interesting because it's like there's this like different merge into like a whole different world in itself.
Yeah, it does happen. It's happened quite a lot in my bloodline, actually, in terms of how people have traveled and moved around. And you sort of get little pieces of all the cultures, and that comes together to build its own sort of culture. So I do completely understand what you're getting at, man. It's very interesting because my mother is Nigerian Brazilian, and my dad is Angolan Portuguese. So obviously, both of those, in their own regards, are smaller cultures within themselves. So obviously, them coming together, my household was the next thing. We spoke bare languages in my house. Do you get it? So it's just understanding who I'm around and how I should step forward.
Yeah.
Step forward, if you know what I mean.
Mm. Well, yeah, culture's liquid. It's not solid, right? Unless you're really protective of your culture, which I think some people are because of history and so much more, where they don't let anybody else come in. They want to keep steadfast to their rules and so much more. That's when you see culture being a little bit more solid. But I think as we're being exposed more and more to the Western world, our Western ideas, people are starting to leave and people are starting to realize that it's through the access to different information you really broaden your worldview. And I think, as you said, that well, we know that, you know, Brazilians are all different colors, you know, because they had the biggest slave ports in the world technically during slavery. And Brazilians, I think it's Bahia, I think if I've pronounced it correctly, that's the biggest African population outside of Africa. And there's a massive Japanese population even in Brazil as well. Mm. Even with Angola as well, you know, the Portuguese influence has had a profound effect. You know, you look at the way history has been shaped, and quite often it's been shaped by events of the past that have really changed the way we see culture today. And it's a hard conversation for people to have, that even some of the things that I speak about, how I want to move the needle but not diminish the Caribbean culture in any way, shape or form. But there's a lot of redundant ideas that I grew up with that didn't serve me. But that's because I was exposed to the Western world. Whereas when I speak to my mum, she says to me, that's not what she grew up with. It's not what she knew. Like, my mum told me the first time she ever saw someone that was gay, it was in the UK. You know, like, she didn't see that in Trinidad, where I'm from. And just these things have such a profound, you know, impact on our lives. That's why I think culture is something we have to speak about more. But in speaking about culture, we can actually criticize, we can actually, you know, also talk about the things that make us happy within culture, but we have to be careful to not romanticize parts of the culture, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think and I think when it comes to culture in itself, it's either going to unite people or divide people.
Mm.
And I think it's that thing of like, what am I looking for? Am I looking for something that's going to divide me from that person? I'm looking for something that's going to unite me, because there is that whole thing of like, the foundation is that we're all human, right? It's like we all have that in common. And I was going to ask you guys this as well. Yeah, I actually believe that we're all related. Do you guys think we're all related, or do you believe in that?
Well, I suppose it's the idea, if we're all born from Africa, then we all technically be related.
Is that as well? And then the other thing I was thinking about is like, on a slightly different element, I got two parents, yeah? My parents got two parents each as well. So that's four. Then it's like eight people. Then there's 16 and there's whatever, 32, 64. And it just kind of keeps going, innit? So at one point, we all come from the same thing, right? We all come from being a human. And I think what's maybe happened, different parts of the world, different conditions, we just shaped in a different way as we adapted. And we must have been around for thousands of years, man.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Because, you know, like, we can look at a hundred years, it's like, that's even 100 years won't make that much of a difference within a human being. So we must have been for such a long time. Because even now they're saying that apparently the way we hold our phones, at some point this finger is going to bend if we keep obviously holding the phones in the future and all of that stuff.
Well, you're right. And even if we look at the way modern life has us, you know, our hip flexors get shortened, our glutes shut down, our hamstrings get lengthened as a result of overcompensating for how much we sit down. And most people can't squat like a child. You ever seen children that can just squat absolutely arse to the grass?
They love it.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. The more and more you realize that we're changing who we are physically, you know, anatomically and so much more, but it makes a lot of sense that these things wouldn't have happened just over, you know, a day or a night. It just would have happened as a result of constant change and the change and the evolving of our lives. And the human body has a fantastic way of adapting to the pressures and the needs put on it. So it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, even what you were saying before about the phone, apparently we have a tendon. We're starting to grow a new tendon in our thumb because of the amount of use that we are just doing this all the time. To get crazy scenes. And I just believe that, yeah, just due to the changes that we are going through as humans, like we're sat so much. I'm sat right now. But we sit so much, not even necessarily here, maybe on public transport, at home, when we're driving to places, when we're taking our bikes to places, we're just always sat.
We're sedentary more than we ever have been.
So a friend of mine, shout out Aaron, by the way, he made this point. It goes when I'm driving, I'm actually sitting on a sofa. I'm sitting on a sofa. I'm on a train, I'm sitting on a sofa. Like, everyone's sitting on a sofa constantly. like doing whatever they're doing at that time.
Some people argue it's psychologically preparing you to constantly be on a sofa.
So there's one light question I wanted to ask you before I want to get into a little bit into OCD, understand what it is and what it means, if that's cool with you.
Yeah, for sure.
But one of the light questions I wanted to ask you as well is, have you guys seen some women, you know, get a whole BBL done.
Yeah.
For those who don't know what that is, it's Brazilian butt lift. You can Google it if you want.
More dangerous than heart surgery.
Yeah, this is dangerous. People can die from it. But there's a new thing happening now. So there's a men's version of BBL, which is...
Or the DBL.
No. It's not that. It's the long... So they can basically...
We're coming back to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can come back to that as well. I don't know what it is, but I want to hear about that.
You lying.
I don't, bro.
But it's the ones where they inject... I think it's some kind of acid or something to increase dick or penis length.
Oh yeah, so width. If anyone knows about any surgeons for that one, shout at me.
Man,
yeah.
Like.
Nah, I'm joking. It's a joke. But yeah, so the thing I was gonna say, people can basically make themselves taller. Now.
Yeah,
they can extend the legs.
Well, it's more they break the leg and they put something in between it, and it takes like a year or two years to walk again.
Yeah, they break a leg and they have to go through like the walking therapy.
Yeah, yeah, it's a serious thing, you know.
That's crazy.
Hella men are doing it now as a result.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, them. Really and truly.
Yeah. Is this true, bro. I'll send you a video after.
It's crazy. I think I did see something like that on maybe like The Shade, bro, or something like that.
No, it's a real thing, man.
Yeah, I saw it, but I didn't know that this was such a phenomenon like this.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But... Do you know how crazy it is not to walk for 2 years? Even just the learning to walk process.
Yeah, it's not like a year, but yeah, it's mad.
But I think that's as a result of insecurities, man. I think, look, and I often say this to people, that a woman is allowed to be anything she wants to be. You know, we have to accept women in society, regardless how big they are, regardless what they've done in the past. We're allowed to, you know... We have to, women empowerment. But if a guy's short, if a guy's overweight, and a guy's ugly, everyone expects him to sit in his place. And as a result of that, you know, men are not earning as much money as they ever have been. Men who are short now, you know, short men are the most disadvantaged in the workplace. Short men are the least likely to get promotions. Short men, they're not taken seriously by people. And you see that height has a big part to play in the romantic market, in people take, you know, see it, most CEOs in the world are 6'1" and above. That tells you something of how evolutionary we're drawn to height, we're drawn to size. And I think a good example of it is, if you look at like MMA fighters or Muay Thai fighters, you might not take them seriously if you see them on the street, but if you see a bodybuilder, you're more likely to be frightened of them, because we assume mass means strength.
And it really doesn't.
Yeah, and the same way women assume quite often that height is a good indicator of a good partner, but that's more evolutionarily based.
That's what I'm gonna say. I think that's just more like, that's not, it's not a conscious thing, right? It's something that happens subconsciously, and it just,
I think some of it's conscious.
Yeah, yeah. I think it starts subconsciously, and they outrightly change that to a conscious factor.
Well, obviously there's evidence that shows as women get older, they can't be as picky, because the biological clock starts to tick. And to a lot of people, that's offensive, but it's the reality.
Cold hard.
Like, men, our earning potential goes up as we get older. Really and truly, you know, the more and more men start to realize that your height shouldn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, but then you'd have to treat men on an equal playing field regardless if they're tall or short.
But then, do you know what, it goes back to that thing. So like, obviously, I'll be honest, I don't know the origins of why women start doing BBL, but I'm guessing there's men out there who maybe liked certain aesthetics, or they wanted something particular, so maybe they started doing because of that. And obviously, maybe feeling insecure is probably the catalyst of that. But I think, and it's kind of like a similar thing to what I'm seeing in the conversations happening now. You get this, there's Just Lonely Things, there's, you have other podcasts out there. I'll start thinking about something else. But yeah, but basically, so like, there's a lot of conversation now where women are saying like, yo, like, I want a 6 foot guy, I want a this or whatever. So I'm not surprised that certain guys who might feel insecure might go, you know what, for me to get that woman, I need to...
Well, social media has created unrealistic expectations. Some people don't realize, if you delete your social media and you go and live in the real world, you realize the real world is a very different place, man. You realize that most people, you realize that a lot of what's put on the internet is, well, it's an echo chamber, and it's within certain communities. Like, when I've gone to certain debates and so much more, I'm not a big fan of the whole movement of, you know, certain types of coaching out there, because I think it's not realistic and it doesn't play out in the long run. But a lot of it is just delete your social media and go and live in the real world. And I think as men, we're born and we're used to rejection, right? We're used to getting knocked back. We're used to someone saying no. We have to get on with it. And we don't really have any other choice, do we? We don't, really and truly. So they say that, you know, hardship makes a man more masculine because he has to survive, he has to keep going. But it also breaks a lot of men.
That's very true.
That's not every man's built the same as a result of it. And it's easy for me to turn around and say, short men, don't worry. Like, I'm not short. I'm 6'3", right? So I'm lucky. I've got a privilege to be able to live like that. But I think if we're going to equalize the world for women, we need to equalize the world for men as well. And some people would say the stuff that's happening now needs to happen to make society a better place. But I don't agree with that. I think we're conscious and we're, you know, we're clearly human beings that want the best for the world. And I think we need to iron out all those problems that are happening in society and not think that by taking away from one, we're empowering another. We're not. We're just creating more of a seesaw.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting, man. And did you want to say
something? No, go. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, and I feel like there's a lot of things in the world that will basically suppress the real sort of mission that we're on, which is like making humanity like one and just connected and all of that stuff. And there's a lot, like even what you said about social media, like Instagram, for instance, like I look at it as like it's just a place for highlights. Like people post highlights. Like now that I reflect on it, I've rarely posted anything like any of my low moments. Like my low moments, I just go through it by myself. But every time I posted, it was something that I was in a moment of like maybe I valued or just it was like a high moment. And a lot of people do that basically. I don't see people post much of like if they're going through something. And when people do post stuff, when they're going through stuff, it's like I see there's a lot of people that get attracted to that because that's the rule. That's the real shit. It's not, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a big craving for realness now. People want realness, man.
I saw somewhere that different social media is for different types of people.
Yeah.
So you have like Twitter, the people who always want to comment and be speaking, people who always want an active conversation. You have Instagram, the people who always want some kind of, they don't really want to speak. They'll just show you exactly what's going on.
Aesthetics.
Quick ones, do you get me? There's just a huge list of stuff. So it made me sit and think, like, what type of person am I, and why am I more drawn to this form of, like, I don't really tweet. I don't really tweet at all. If you see my Twitter is dry, come like a fish out of water. Serious, it's the next thing. But that's mainly
for that. No, just
but that's mainly because the way society has you. If you make a mistake online, whether big or small, someone's going to point it out. Someone's going to point it out.
Yeah.
And you see me, bro, I've got dyslexia on the next thing. So the way I wouldn't really be concentrating in typing, I'll just type away and then go back and then realize I done did fumble the bag. Just delete the whole Twitter, bro. All of it.
But well, there's people in newspapers now who they scan through people's tweets. They scan through people's Instagrams to find dirt to dig up on them.
That's crazy.
Well, that's how they find that's how they found Maya Jama's colorist tweets when she put down darker skinned women. That's how they found a lot of people like that, you know.
That's interesting. Have you
fire for you people?
Have you followed what they're called, Fresh and Fit? Have you seen what they're doing?
Yeah, and I think I don't agree with everything that they do, but I think they're a classic example of they've got a target market. Their target market is Miami. They literally expose how stupid a lot of people are in Miami.
But I think just going back to the target audience, I think a lot of the target audience are like, how can I say this without sounding offensive? I think men that are just like basically bums in life and they need some kind of kick up the ass, and sometimes the kick up the ass is the harsh one because they give out a lot of harsh messages to men.
But then let me ask you a question. We don't describe women as bums when they don't work. We don't really describe them if, you know, they're just doing whatever. We don't describe them as bums. We have empathy. We've got some sense of sympathy. If a guy's hard done by, right, and he's struggling in life, and I think there needs to be more of a sense of compassion.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good point, you know. I see that. Yeah.
And compassion doesn't mean weakness, though. Compassion doesn't mean I sit here and I allow you to stay in it. I allow you to have your time to process it, but we've got to keep moving forward. And quite often for men, when men are angry, they turn inwards, right? And they go out and they become successful in the world. Like, that's why they say when rappers have trauma, what do? They get rich. They think being rich will solve all their traumas.
It's true. And society really be playing on that, you know? Because it's like, which artist was it that was going in a relationship and then they broke up? I think it was was it Rihanna and Chris Brown? And someone was, as soon as they broke up, they were like, well, Chris Brown is about to have some bangers. Guys, get ready.
Yeah.
And like, would you not rather think, yo, like, let the man have some time to grieve. Let him understand that he's gone.
Wow.
Even with Burna Boy.
Mm.
Even when Burna Boy broke up with Steph London.
Well, apparently he cheated on her, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know anything about the situation.
But you know, that proves that looks mean nothing in the grand scheme.
It really doesn't.
Like,
yeah.
I think a lot of women have decided that if I've got the nicest body in the world, if I'm pretty, that a man won't cheat on you. That doesn't buffer you from cheating. It has nothing to do with that. And I'm not saying that it's okay for men to cheat in any way, shape or form, but that proves the very point. Mm. Jay-Z cheated on Beyonce, that proves the point.
Yeah. Do you know what? That's interesting, because I think for me, my insight of life or my perspective of life is that personally, I don't look at people's skin color, like how much money. I don't care about none of that stuff. Mm. Yeah, personally, it might have some kind of subconscious effect maybe from conditioning in the past, but I really don't care. What I really care about is how much of a human is that person, because there's going to be a different spectrum of how human that person is. By human, I mean like how much they care about other people. Mm. And also, what are the values? I think values is something that people don't talk about. It's very, very important, because you can see people's values through actions and how they deal with things, and it will just come out. You don't have to talk to them about it. You'll see them through actions. So for me, it's just that thing of like, that's what people don't understand. It's like, people might look in a certain way, they might have a particular car, whatever, but their values might be mad.
Well, yeah, there's a great book I'm listening to about happiness, and it was talking about, there's like four archetypes of happiness. There's the rat racer, who he doesn't care about the process. He only cares about, you know, getting towards the end goal. He cares about the 9-to-5. Everything matters at the end goal. And even when he gets there, he just keeps going on this hedonistic treadmill. And then there's also the nihilist. The nihilist doesn't believe in any sort of happiness. They believe in sadness, depression. They think nothing ever gets better. It stays the way it is. And there's one more, if I'm trying to remember correctly. There's, I can't remember the other one, but there's also the happiness archetype, who they learn to love the process. They learn to really enjoy every single day that comes with it. And I think that's a massive part of values. I think a big part of values is to try and remain present in the moment. Whereas I think a lot of us aren't always able to do that, because we're always worried about the next thing. Mm. And in society, we're taught that if we don't have our head screwed on, that we should be worried about something, you know? And I think meditation always reminds us to sit in that present.
Mm. Yeah. Personally, I've realized myself that I've been too away on socials and not in the present moment much. So like, I've been on a few holidays this year, and every time I went on holiday, like, I'd rarely bring up my phone to snap what
and,
I'm doing.
And that's a good thing.
But looking back, it's like, I don't have the memory. The memory is with the person who was actually taking the pictures. Do you get it? But I have the moment. I have the enjoyment of what was actually happening there and then.
I think you can use it to your advantage though, right? You can take some pictures, and then you can go out. The other thing I was supposed to say was the hedonist. The hedonist only cares about pleasure. Pleasure is the only thing that's super important. So that's another archetype. Mm. But I think you can use social media and you can use your phone to your advantage. Mm. You can still take photos and enjoy the moment. But I think one of the things we see is, you ever spoken to young kids nowadays? Kids are glued to their phone, because psychologically they're addicted to social media. And I think we're all guilty of it in some way, shape or form. For example, a lot of us are guilty of this, and I'm guilty of this, that the first thing we do before we wake up, when we wake up, is we check our phone. Very first thing we do.
Yeah.
We don't brush our teeth. We don't do a lot of other things. We check our phone, because phones have become such an integral part of our lives. But awareness is half the battle. If you could go on holiday and take photos and still enjoy it, but not be stuck on your phone, why not?
Yeah, I need one of them old school. Mm-hmm. And the print just comes out at the bottom. Just... Yeah.
But do you know what? And on a slightly different perspective, like, for example, like, you're someone that I appreciate. So when you do, like, when you went away on holidays or whatever, and I see you post certain things and I see you having a good time, I'm like, yo, this is lit. So, like, you're still, like... And obviously, some people might look at it like, oh, this guy's just showing off or whatever. People have different...
How dare they?
No, but I would say people have different perspectives, right? But for a perspective from people that care about you, they'll see certain things that you're doing and go like, rah, this is lit. Like, I'm happy you're having a good time or whatever. And you might even, like, sometimes I think, I'm not going to say what holiday you went on, I was like, yeah, I need to book that one as well.
Okay. I don't mind. I went Amsterdam, I went Paris.
No, I'm talking about like last year. I'm talking about Afro-Nation.
Afro-Nation.
Yeah. I was like, yo, man should be there, bro. Like,
nah, it was good.
Man should be there, bro.
It's really good. But even like at Afro-Nation, like, I know you saw like some good bits that I highlighted, but I lost my phone for half of the time. I was just enjoying what was going on.
Yeah.
And the fact that I lost my phone, I was fuming, but I was like, it is what it is. Phone done. I'll get a new one when I get back to London. For now, just going to enjoy what I've got in the present. Luckily, I came back with my phone. Whoever put my phone in the bush, yeah, cool. But yeah, I managed to find my phone, come back to London. But it's just being stuck in the moment.
Yeah.
Being stuck and actually enjoying the present. Man, it was delicious to the taste.
Yeah.
Did you know what's funny about that word? It's a present, isn't it? Like, it's the actual present.
It's a gift, yeah.
It's
yeah.
a gift, man. The present moment is a gift. Yeah, bro, OCD, man. Mm. Obviously, I know a little bit about it, but I feel like you can probably explain a bit better. Like, what is OCD? And I guess, like, I've kind of got a question for you as well. Let me just pull it up real quick.
We'll go one at a time.
Huh?
We'll go one question
at a time. Guess what's OCD? And then I have a following one after.
Yeah, no, OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder. It's a mental illness, a neurodivergency, if you will, where your brain can create unwanted, repetitive, intrusive thoughts that are ego dystonic, meaning it's against your values. So in the sense of, for me, during my breakdown, I was terrified I was going to hurt people. I was terrified I was going to be a sexual assaulter, like a killer and whatnot. I was terrified that I was gay. I was terrified I was suicidal. So it was throwing these thoughts quite at me quite often. That's the best way to describe OCD. And a lot of people think OCD is just about cleaning and symmetry, which is, you know, it's as a result of the media, but these conversations set that straight.
Because that's what I was looking into. I was like, after I looked into it, and you know what's funny? Yeah, I'm guilty of that. Because like I was, that's what I used to know. And that's because of the media or whatever. That's what I've been kind of, that's the thing, like, yeah, OCD's like, I know I got a friend. He's kind of like always wants to clean things or whatever. And I started looking into it. I was like, actually, it's way more than that. And I guess like one of the things that you said on one of your clips that I've seen, you said that people should seek diagnosis as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And I guess like my question is like, how does being diagnosed help? And like maybe like what changes after that?
So for me, I was living with it for about 5 to 6 years. I was living utterly and entirely in my head. I wasn't in the present. It took me a very long time to get to the place where I am now, where I can still have the thoughts. It just does not bother me the same way that it does. OCD is not, it's not the umbrella that shields me from the sun. This time it's the stick that I walk alongside with to help assist me in life. That's the best way. It's the best way for me to describe it.
What?
Actually, I thought of that.
Put
I thought
it in
of
a
that.
Book somewhere, Jay.
I thought of that. I thought of that off the spot, actually.
Yo,
but
trademarked to my man over here.
Just trademark 2023.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'd say that's the best way to describe it. But for me, the diagnosis helped to give me clarity in the sense of now I understood I wasn't gay, I wasn't going to hurt women, and I wasn't suicidal. I realized that my relationship with my brain is now very different in the sense of you can't believe every story that goes on in your head. You know, your brain is a creature of volume and repetition. What you put into it will constantly pour out. And that's a good example. So if I have a certain thought and I start obsessing on it and I start ruminating, so I start thinking over, my brain will throw it more at me because that's what the brain evolutionary is wired to do. The brain is wired to protect you from danger. That's really and truly what it's like living with OCD and anxiety. But for me, diagnosis helped create a community that I'm able to be a big part of. I'm able to discuss things. I'm able to have these conversations with you guys, for example, how I can use the platform that I've had previously with modeling and public speaking a little bit more alongside my mental health advocacy. So it exposes me to a new range of people. And in some ways, I'm not saying I want OCD, but if it wasn't for OCD, I wouldn't be where I am now. I think I could have been a very different person. People have killed themselves as a result of OCD because they can't deal with the thoughts. They feel like the thoughts say something so bad about them. They feel like they're a terrible person. And diagnosis really gave me a lot of clarity. I think that's the best way. It gave me clarity. It gave me a community, but also it gave me hope. And hope is the one thing that I needed the most when I was in my dark space last year. It's been a year since recovery. It gave me something to look forward to realize that OCD is just not, it's not just going to get up and go away. But I learned to live with it, as I said. It no longer shields me from the sun.
Can you, by any chance, because I know you're quite busy at the moment with the camera, can you look up, you know that story that I know shares around, like when someone shares the story, the shame dies? If Yeah, I'm not sure, but I think it should be online.
Oh, no shocker, yeah.
Oh, you know, so you know what, actually, that I have to look it up. But basically, I can't remember the exact saying, but he says that, you know, when people basically say their story or when they share their story, that the shame dies. And kind of like, so I guess what I'm hearing from what you said is that the transition has been like a lot of things were internal, and then you start becoming like really woke about sharing a story and just like, and do you feel like that applied to you or?
Yeah, when you share a story, it's a burden halved. Mm. And I think the more I tell my stories, the less I'm a prisoner to it. I think I've been freed from the chains of OCD in the sense of, I know what it was. If I keep living in shame, I'm not doing anything good for me internally. And people like Shocker, like, he's a big inspiration. Obviously, he's been sectioned 4 times, which he talks about openly. And he lives with his illness, and he really goes on to help and inspire other people. And that tells you a lot about who he is as an individual. But yeah, for me, when I first shared my story, I think it was on the 15th of August last year, I remember when I wrote the story and I put it out there, I remember I was terrified that people were going to think I'm crazy and I'm mad. But so many people reached out to me and said, I have OCD as well. Thank you for sharing your story. Mm. I was able to just create a community out of the hardship that I went through. And that's why they often say on the other side of pain, there's purpose. And I think that's what I've been able to find, really and truly. But yeah, sharing my story really, it killed a lot of the shame for me. I lived in my head. For 5 to 6 years, I just lived internally. I was terrified that if I spoke to people about my thoughts, that they'll just think I'm a terrible person. And for a lot of people, I know they're the most well-meaning, but if you tell somebody you're having certain kinds of thoughts, some people are like, hey, brother, like, you're moving a bit mad, you know? Or like, yo, like, what's going on? They can put more fear and anxiety into you. So from doing that, now I want to get the tools on top of my lived experience, but therapeutically speaking, to be able to help other people.
That's beautiful, man. That's so powerful. A person that I hold really dear as well, Robin Lockhart, he actually talks about, I think, I can't remember exactly.
Come on.
You know what I'm saying? But yeah, he talks about, I don't know how many thoughts we get, it's like 50,000 or 100, I don't
something,
know.
Yeah, something like 60,000 or
something
like
crazy,
that.
But he always says like, look, we're not what our thoughts are.
Yeah.
And it's just about like, if he acted on every single thought, then we'd be crazy. Like, everyone would look at every single person crazy because it's the intrusive thoughts, isn't it? If you get a lot of these intrusive thoughts. And he spoke about meditation earlier. So one of the things that I do in the morning, and I struggle with it afternoon, I try to do in my workplace sometimes, but I can't because there's a lot of stuff going on. But in the morning is the best place where I sit down for 10 minutes in silence. You know, people call it meditation, but I don't. My thing is just I just sit in silence. And I try not to shut my brain off. So I just notice what the thoughts are, what are the thoughts that's coming in. And just kind of look at them and go, this is really interesting.
You practice non-judgment.
Yeah, rather than just saying, like, oh, I need to get this thought out of my head.
Yeah.
I look at it and I go like, oh, that's interesting. I think
that's the issue with OCD. A lot of people with OCD, they go, no, I can't have this thought. No. This means I'm a bad person. That's what the brain goes, all right, cool. They've paid attention to this thought. Let's throw it back at them.
And the more they resist it, the more it keeps coming
back. Absolutely. So it's like a tug of war. When you learn to let go of the rope, you learn to just be like, I think there's a great metaphor in something called ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, which I've done. I want to go back to it. Let's say you're driving a ship, right? And there's these demons on the ship and you accidentally have opened the trap door. These demons come and they're poking you, they're prodding you, they're screaming at you. I want your attention. You just got to keep driving the ship. The minute you pay into these demons, you stop driving and you'll crash. So it's an incredible way to think about meditation. You let the demons sit there, and eventually they're like, bruv, this guy's not giving us no attention, you know? So it's almost like that annoying fly or that child who wants your attention. Eventually they'll die down. Mm-hmm. Eventually they'll be like, oh, God, I just can't get their attention, you know?
No, I agree, though. I agree. It's something quite hard-hitting about what you're saying, because there's some people who actually haven't heard it. There's some people who this is brand-new information for them. So I'm just happy that you're actually here to tell your story, man. Once you got diagnosed, would you say that they, because it's obviously a systematic thing, but yours is quite personal to each individual. Would you say that you were sort of ushered towards more therapy? Would you say you were ushered towards more the medicative route? Would you say what were your steps forward from once you were
diagnosed?
Once you were diagnosed, what were the next steps going forward?
So for me, what happened was when I look back and I was, under different institutions such as IAPT, you know, like Improving Access to Psychological Therapy. They, a long time ago, believed I had OCD, but this is how you know I wasn't in the headspace. Like, I wasn't reading their letters, but I lived in my head, like, constantly, 24/7. What happened for me, and let me explain this. So I was seeing somebody, and when I was with them, I was high on cannabis, yeah? And this intrusive thought popped in of rape. I just lost my shit, basically. There's no other way for me to put it. I became so terrified I was going to act on my thought. I remember I tried to convince myself I was hearing voices. I tried to convince myself that, you know, I was going mad. And I remember I screamed at her, get out of the house, get out. You can't be here. She was like, Sean, you're going to be okay. I said, no. I'm going mad. I'm going crazy. And I kept asking her, have I done something to you? She was like, you haven't done anything to me, Sean. I was like, but for me, I couldn't get this anxiety out of my head. So she left, right? And I tried to go to sleep. And when I tried to sleep, just intrusive thoughts of murder and blood flashed into my head. And I was like, I can't do this no more. Mm. Went downstairs, put on my coat, got my keys, and I gave my keys where I live. There was a COVID testing center back then. This was like during COVID times. And I remember I was just walking up and down. I was like, I'm going crazy. I'm hearing voices. I'm mad. What's going on? And the woman was like, no, you're fine. You're just, you're high. That's it. So when I was sober again, I was like, I'm okay. Mm. Like, what's going on? And my friend came to check up on me, and the mental health team came to check for me, took me to the St. George's Hospital where I live. And I was like, nah, I'll be okay. I'll start therapy. So I started psychodynamic therapy, and psychodynamic therapy for OCD is not the one. That's not the one that you want, because you're almost trying to get to the root of why you think the way you do. Hmm. If you're having thoughts against your morals and values, you don't want to try and figure it out because you're going down a rabbit hole. Hmm. Rumination is like sitting in a rocking chair and expecting to go forward.
In what ways are you trying? Sorry, just to understand exactly what psychodynamic therapy is, what thoughts of trying to find the root cause, but in what way?
So in the sense of, you talk about it, it's like talking therapy. Okay. You're trying to figure it out. But for OCD, you don't need talking therapy. You're supposed to have something called CBT, ERP, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure response prevention. And I just reached a point where I was out with one of my boys, and suicide just popped into my head. Like, I saw an image of me jumping off of a bridge, and I was like, can't do this no more. Like, I just remember I looked at him and I was like, bro, I want to die. I said, I can't do this no more. Jumped in an Uber. I was just so depressed, and I got home, I was crying my eyes out. My boy just started crying, and I called one of my other friends, and none of my friends knew what was going on. I didn't know what was going on in my head. And I had this thing called toxic guilt, which is a big part of OCD, where I felt like I was being punished in some senses for all the mistakes I made. So I called up people I had done wrong, and so much more. I was like, I'm just so sorry. And I was hoping that it was going to help me get better. I was hoping that it was going to, you know, bring me some alleviation from my anxiety, and none of that happened, man. And it was on Saturday the 4th of June, I woke up and I was just like, I just can't do this no more. I reached out to several therapists, several institutions. I was broke. I didn't realize that as a result of OCD, I had no finances, man. I just couldn't hold down a job. I couldn't do anything. I've had to really rebuild my life more than people can ever imagine. And I found this therapist online called Emma Garrick, otherwise known as the Anxiety Whisperer. And I just begged her for a phone call, and she picked up the phone, and I just started crying, man. Mm. Burst out crying. I just said to her, what's wrong with me? I said, please, I don't want to hurt anyone. Please, what's going on? She was like, Sean, you have OCD. And we began therapy on Monday. And during that call on the Saturday, I said to her, am I going to ever get better? She was like, Sean, I have OCD as well, and I'm living a perfectly normal, happy life. And it was one of the toughest things I've ever had to recover from, because you're at war with your own mind. Mm. You realize you don't need to bite every bullet that comes into your head. And I also do believe I have unsuspected ADHD for sure. But yeah, for me, OCD really brought me to despair.
Mm. When you were in school, whether it's primary school, secondary school, college, university even, were there any times that you were ushered by maybe your tutors, your professors to sort of get this checked out? This might be something that you have. This might, that you might be able to find some support with it.
You know what's really funny, right? In typical Caribbean fashion, when I was looking through some stuff in my house, I found my school report. And my school report, when I was around, I think it was 8 or 9, they said they believed I had ADHD. But my mom hid that from me. And I think the Caribbean culture, they want to not put a label on you. And I absolutely understand why. My dad died on Christmas Day when I was 6 years old. And it deeply traumatized my mum. And I think my mum, she just didn't want to put labels on me, I think. Because she denies it to this day, but there's clear evidence. And some of the things that they said was, Sean doesn't know how to handle rejection. I was like, wow, this makes a lot of sense. Because even in my friendship groups, I used to feel really personally attacked when, if I agree to do something with you, let's say if we agree to do something, I'd rather you turn up late than not turn up at all. Mm. If you just cancel on me last minute, it gets to me and I take it personally. But now I've had to learn to distinguish myself between some people's issues are more deep-rooted than your existence will ever be. Mm. And sometimes it's just not personal to you. And I didn't realize that that was a symptom of ADHD. A lot of these things are symptoms. It's a neurodivergency. And but there's a lot of strength that comes with ADHD, such as we know it to be the novelty-seeking gene. If it wasn't for people with ADHD, people would argue that we wouldn't have explored humanity and explored society and traveled all across the world. We needed people who were neurodiverse, quote-unquote, compared to the neurotypical. That's not shade on the neurotypical. There's a lot of strength that comes with being neurotypical, but there's also a lot of strength that comes with being neurodiverse. But society is not adapted in a way that strengthens it. But it makes a lot of sense for me, realizing that I have ADHD behaviors. Like I start one thing and I can't finish another. I've been a police officer. I've been, you know, a sports athlete. I've been worked in retail stores. I've struggled to hold down relationships. There's a lot of stuff that I've realized. I'm not going to chalk it all up to ADHD and OCD, but I think a lot of it's trauma. And we know how trauma exacerbates certain neurodivergency symptoms. So yeah, to some regards, I probably would have been ushered, but I've only recently found that out now.
But do you know, I think it's really beautiful. It's about, you know, they say that to realize or to work on a problem, you first have to accept the problem. We need to know what the problem is.
Agreed.
And I think what's beautiful about it is just like you're recognizing certain things. And I think for me as well, in my past, like I had to recognize certain issues. But until I accepted the issues, until I said, you know what, that's actually a problem, I couldn't work on it. Because I was basically ignorant towards it, because I'm like, it's not actually a problem.
Yeah.
But when I kept telling that to myself, the problem became bigger.
Absolutely.
To the point where it gets so big, it's just like, I have to go, you know what? That's a problem for me. And when I go, that's a problem for you, now it's cool. How do I work on it?
Well, the idea is when you run from pain, pain will always chase you back.
Mm.
Unresolved issues don't get any smaller. They get bigger and bigger as time goes on. It's the idea of, if you sweep the dragon under the carpet doesn't go away and the dragon doesn't go away. It just gets stronger and stronger. And that's the best way to think about a lot of the problems in your life, that it's going to be hard to confront. You've got to confront a lot of issues. And I've got a lot of issues still in my life I want to confront, right? I found out I had a half-brother. He died, unfortunately, when I got the chance to really, you know, have a conversation with him. I've realized that a lot of my childhood, there's a lot of issues that I really need to sort out. But that's why I say that you can't ignore your problems in the hope that it's just going to go away. And I think for a lot of men, sadly, there's a couple of guys in the gym that I've got big respect for and big reverence, and they see a lot of the work I do and they hold me to high respect, and I'm grateful because that's man them, do you know what I mean? Man them who don't look down on me any less for what I've gone through. They respect me, right? One of the guys was like, his mum's got cancer, you know, she's terminal. And I'm like, bro, you know, it's okay to be upset. And you can see the guy wants to cry on the gym floor. And I said, bro, it's all right, you know. He's like, nah, man. He said, I got to get my money up, got to get this workout in, I got to work. And I was like, bro, it's okay, bro.
That's actually like the opposite. Like, it's almost like he's looking for ways of coping. And sometimes this is what I explore as well, what I've been exploring in the last year. You know, some people got coping mechanisms, right? They might seem, obviously, not even might seem, they are positive. So some of them might be gym, might be getting the extra money, whatever it is. It's a positive thing. But however, it doesn't work on the foundation of the issue. Like, his mum still got cancer. Like, whether he gets the money up, whether he works out more, even after she passes away, whatever he does after that, even if it seems like positive, he's still not dealing with a foundational issue.
Mm.
The problem is still there.
It's true, man.
You know what I'm saying?
It's true. And I think sometimes that also deals with, no, it also relates back to how people deal with their feelings, you know?
Yeah.
Some people just can't, they can't cry. Some people can't cry. It's a thing. Some people don't cry because of the environments that they're in. I remember quite strongly from when my grandma died. Like, it sounds bad, but I was around too many family members to lay down all of the tears that I wanted to. Yeah, I still cried, but when I got back, and I was in the, just in my room, bawling. Yeah. Bawling, waterfall, Cyrus, crying. But it was like, I needed my family to understand, in this moment, I'm upset and I'm broken, but I'm still here holding everybody together.
And the thing is, I think a lot of men feel like it's just not okay to cry, you know? Like one of my friends, my best friend, he's taught me such big lessons in life, and he's been like a father figure to me. And I get emotional whenever I think about it, because I said to him, bro, if it wasn't for you, I don't know where I'd be. Like, you've taught me so much about what it is to be a man, and it's okay for me to be emotional. It's okay for me to be the way that I am. But I remember there was times when I was just harsh, right? Because I grew up in an environment where it was, shut up, man. Like, no one cares about your feelings, man. Mm. Or suck it up, you keep moving. Whereas with him, he'll cry, he'll have his little moment, and he'll pick himself up and keep going. And I think it's okay to have that moment. It's all right, right? As long as you don't get stuck in it, there's a balance. But for my friend, I learned that. Even when I turned up to my half-brother's funeral, I didn't know how to feel. Because the first, I met my half-brother via the internet, and he's a lot older than me, right? And then when he didn't really care for a relationship the way I wanted to have a relationship. And I found that he died via my therapist. When I was on the phone to my therapist, I said, look, I want to make some goals when I'm out of therapy to go and change my life. I said, I want to really have a relationship with him. Typed in and found that he died. That was it. Mm. I didn't really have a chance. And my dad, he has one more kid that neither of us know about. So I'm on a journey for, I'm seeking meaning, right? But even with my dad, when my dad died, it was only last year I really processed how much I miss my dad. You know, having that male figure around. And there's a love that your mother gives you, but there's a love your father gives you that is unlike any other. You know, I often say that to people, that I was raised by a village of very strong women, but there's a love that a man gives you that is unparalleled to anybody.
I agree.
You're a man that is emotional but vulnerable, and also firm and disciplined at the same time, is underestimated in society. And this is not an attack on any single mothers. I grew up with a single mother. My mum did a fantastic job, but she just wasn't my dad. And I think a lot of the time we try to supplement fathers, you know, but fathers are just so important.
Yeah, masculine love is different to feminine love.
So different. Yeah. Well, women love their child, you know, they treat children as their world. Typically men, we love children in relation to the world. We teach our child to compete. We teach our child how to, you know, not to always toughen up, but to, it's all right, you can cry. Like, even when they experimented on rats, they found out that rats that didn't have the ability to play with their father figure, their father essentially, grew up and they had issues later on down the line. So even rough play is it important for kids to be able to discover their own boundaries. You don't get that with your mother, really and truly. That masculine love is so important. And even if you think about Will Smith, right? Remember that scene in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air where he's upset that his dad just doesn't want him?
Oh, my days. Yeah.
There's a heartbreaking scene. There's a lot of men out there with a father wound. So many, I'm not sure if you've seen, there's a clip on Instagram where there's this grown man holding this man and saying he's rocking him. And essentially he has this retreat for healing the masculine wound, essentially. And some of the comments are mad, right? So some people say, some women especially, I notice, go, there's a healthier way to express emotion. If I saw my man doing this, I'd lose respect. We can't police how people find healing, right? And I think we can't do that for men either. A lot of men like sport. A lot of men like to go down to the pub and have a little drink with the boys. A lot of men, them just like to cook.
You know, that's therapy for some men.
But yeah, and I often say to women that if you want to meet a man in his... and see who he is deep down. Go to where he finds happiness and peace. Go to where he finds sanctuary. Fortnite. If you scream and shout at a man, you're not going to get what you want out of him. I'm not saying you've got to have this enduring patience forever, but I've said to a lot of my friends that if you just seek to understand and to listen, you hear more. It doesn't justify people's behaviours, but you start to realise there's a lot more that goes on that meets the surface.
Because you can kind of go like, you know what, I still disagree with it, but I kind of get it. You know what? There's a lot of people I disagree with, but when I start to understand how they shaped or how the world has shaped them in a particular way, I go, you know what? I disagree with what they're doing, but I get it. I get it. It's been tough for them.
Understanding doesn't mean acceptance.
Yeah.
I'm just touching up on a few of the points that you laid out. Uncle Phil from The Fresh Prince is a very, very solid role model figure.
Absolutely.
That goes to show the different kinds of love between a father figure and a sort of mother figure. So that's quite a good point to relay back to you. Another point that you stated earlier was you spoke on your friends. That's quite a heavy one because your friends have kind of been with you for time, and sometimes expressing these sorts of feelings and emotions towards them will have them thinking that you're moving mad. But in real life, it's just stuff that's going on in your brain. Do you get it? And you just want to speak to your people. These are your people. I should be able to speak to you. You're my people. Do you get it? But in this day and age, just due to how society has it and what their definition of being a bit crazy might be, that might fall under that category. But I'm so happy when you said you told your friends just before you got in that cab and they just sat and cried with you, because it shows that your people have emotions as well. It shows that they're open to expressing these sorts of things, man. And in this life, you need that. If you can't speak to your people, then boy, you have to find new people, because you should be able to express to your people exactly what's
going on. You're right. And my best friend, the more I think about it, I remember one day he said to me he was just really struggling, and he said he was by a bridge, right? And he said he was going to try and take his life. And he said someone spotted him and they called him back. And he said he thought about the people that loved him, and he said he thought about me. And it made me break down in tears. And I said to him, bro, you can't do that to me, man. I said, regardless whatever you're going through, just know it's temporary and know that I'm here for you as a friend. You know what I mean? But like him, he's used to not being able to open up about his emotions. You know, he gets laughed at and mocked at. And I was guilty of that too, that he was a direct reflection of me. My best friend Malcolm, he constantly reminded me of everything that I was, but I didn't want to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you know what? My views on suicide have changed a lot in the last year. I've actually done like quite a few trainings and other things as well. And I've been learning about what it means actually to do that in first place. And there is the element of like, sometimes people can't cope with their pain anymore.
Yeah.
So their pain gets so strong. So I think back in the days, to be like, oh, like, why would someone do that? That's bare selfish. And
Agreed.
I was kind of like thinking like that. But then when I've learned actually what it is for them, the pain gets so difficult that they don't know what else to do. And it's kind of like, it's almost like the last resort just to take that pain away.
I called Samaritans 3 nights in a row when I was willing to take my life. I was thinking, how do I do it? What do I do? And I remember when I was sleeping, before I slept, I was like, I can't sleep. I'm just so anxious. And I said to myself, I don't sleep, I'll wake up and I'll kill myself. And fell asleep and I woke up and I just started crying. I was like, how could I think like that? I wrote suicide notes. And there's a lot of men out there who feel the same. One of my boys, a photographer as well, he had his heart broken by somebody and he just felt so emotional. And I cried with him and he said, bro, the first time he's ever seen someone have emotions with him. Men just need to feel heard, listened and understood. And I think we're in a better time than we ever have been, but there's a lot that needs to change.
Yeah.
You know, like even when I'm on the bus, right, or the train, and man, them are screwing me. I'm just like, bruv, you man are going through some sort of PTSD or something to view me as some sort of enemy. And now I no longer take it personally. I'll be like, bro, you good? And they're like, oh, yeah, I'm good. Like, you nullify the effect.
Do you know what is so mad? That is such a thing, you know?
Yeah. Like, man them screw
the
you.
The amount like of man them that will screw you and you just nod like, oh my God, you saying you're good? Everything just changed.
Yeah.
Do you get it? And it's why?
It's because men are, I think, a lot of guys are used to survival mode. Bro, like, I've lived in survival mode. I've done things that I didn't want to do to survive and make money and get it how I had to. But I'm not going to talk about it here simply for the sake of reputation.
Wrong podcast.
Yeah. There's some stuff I won't talk about. But I think a lot of people just really don't realize that there's a lot of men suffering, you know? Think about it. If one of my boys, he was working, right? And he was staying with me for a while and he smoked weed every night. And it reached a point where I was like, bro, what's going on? And he said, no, I'm fine, man. He said, he's good. I was like, nah, there's something that's not sitting right with me. And he just said to me one day, he said, the full-time job was just getting to him. He said, he's got no time for anything else. Comes back from work. All he can do is smoke a blunt. He can't even train. He can't do anything he wants to do. But that sadness there creeps in if another man doesn't ask him, bro, what's wrong, man? Let's just have a chat about it. I may not be able to solve your issues, but I'm sure someone listening and be like, I hear you. What can we do to move together?
It's a starting point.
Yeah, but, and that's what it is. And suicide, you know, the idea of committing suicide. Remember, suicide used to be a crime.
Yeah, it still is in some countries.
Yeah, so the idea of, you know, some people took their own life, it makes you realize that the pain was too big.
Yeah.
You know, I know a lot of people who have really struggled. They want out of life. And I say this to people, I've been there, man. I wanted to take my life. I had hardship. I had darkness. And I'm so happy that I didn't allow my temporary feelings to make permanent decisions, because that would have changed people's lives forever.
And you know what? And from a perspective of like, so obviously I do youth work. Well, I don't do as much frontline youth work anymore as I used to. But I think what shifted for me as well, that judgmental part has disappeared. And because I'm not judging the person anymore for wanting to do so, like I'm able to have open conversations with them. It's actually more useful than if I came from, yo, like you're selfish, you're this, you're that, because that's very judgmental. And actually for that person, doesn't even make it easier for them to even open up and talk about it, because they're thinking like, right, like I'm talking about this thing, but you're judging me and you're saying all of these things that you perceive it to be rather than actually understanding me, which is a whole different thing.
Just a quick one. Yeah, the point that you spoke on earlier, guys, speak to your people, man. I've been screaming it every time I get on the pod, speak to your people. Everybody has a different watering hole. Some people be down the pub. Do you know what? I realise where mine is. Mine is online on Fortnite. I play video games with a couple of my people, a couple of them are in the room. Yeah,
come on.
You know what it is. But yeah, it's just a place where you guys can speak. Obviously, we do other stuff like kill people in the game, but we still speak. We have open conversation on the game. We sometimes get a bit distracted, but find your watering hole, speak to your people, lay it out, man. Lay it out. Is there anywhere you would recommend if anyone has anything that they need to say?
I'll say find the people that love you the most and people that want to understand you, man. And I mean that on a real. When I went through my breakdown, so many people disappeared. So many people only wanted to be around me for the clout and everything that I was doing. And one thing I've realized, especially in the whole dating scene and everything else, that some people don't care about when you're down and out. They only care when you're up and rising, right? So that's something else I had to realize. I had to learn to distinguish and discern between the fake and the real. And fake doesn't mean someone who disagrees with me. My friends and I disagree on so much stuff. But I know at the end of the day that our relationship means more than the argument that we've had. That's something else I've also had to remember and something else I've had to realize. But talking to your friends, I'm very careful to drink. I'm not much of a drinker because I think some people can end up drowning their sorrows, right? But one thing I've learned in acceptance and commitment therapy is to lean into your pain. It's one of the things of emotional literacy where you're like, all right, I'm feeling sad, you know. All right, I'm feeling anxious. I don't need to get rid of this. Let me sit with this.
Yeah.
Let me write about how I feel. Let me not try to push it away. Let me lean in. And for a lot of men, I'm like, nah, man, I ain't feeling that. That's a dead thing there. And I think a classic example is when men get their heart broken, they're like, back to the streets. That's a classic thing that men do rather than going, do you know what, you actually hurt me, you know.
But you know what, that's where I have different conversations. See, when I see Mandem or my friends, like if they like went for a breakup or whatever, yeah. And obviously, the other Mandem, they might be like, yeah, that like, man's good, like, let's go out, whatever. But I actually go to them like, yo, like, I know what that means. I know whether do you want to talk about it properly? Because obviously, there's a side that men just suppress, and sometimes they pretend like nothing's going on.
Yeah. But they're hurt deep down, you know. You know, some people argue that men love stronger than women. Because they say men love with no real conditions. I'm not sure how true that is. I'll leave that open to your audience. But I know a lot of guys who've been proper heartbroken.
That's the one for the next pod.
Yeah. I can't lie. I've been there before. And I think what's really interesting, when I was going through it, I didn't talk to no one about it. Actually, I did. You know, that's a lie. I spoke to one person. But aside from talking to him, I didn't talk to no one. Like, I just kind of kept and just firmed it. And it's a whole different story. But one of the other things I wanted to get into, we kind of touched on it a little bit, but I just want to explore a little bit more before we wrap up, is in one of the shows you've been part of as well, you said at one point, or interviews, you said that weak men are more dangerous in a society than strong men.
Yeah.
And obviously, personally, I agree with that. I don't know how you feel about that, but I wanted to understand what you meant by that, and maybe we can have a quick conversation on it as well.
Well, weak men seek power everywhere that they go, right? A strong man understands with great power comes great responsibility. Right? So if you're looking after your family, you've got to take care of your family. That's heavy as the head that wears the crown, right? I know that's not the official saying, as one of my boys who studies philosophy always says to me, but it's that kind of idea. And a weak man will go around seeking power. He'll seek to destroy society because he wants his pain to be felt. He wants his pain to be understood. He wants just someone to listen to him. Think about school shooters, right? We know a lot of them are young boys, unfortunately. And there's a story, there's a young man, well, he's a bit of an older gentleman now, Aaron Stark, and I'm a big fan of his work. You guys should check him out. But he created a TED Talks where he said, I was going to be a school shooter. And he said he got the gun, he walked into the school ready to spray up everybody. And someone just asked him, "How, bro, what's up? He just broke down.
With the gun?
Yeah, obviously they took the gun off him. But
oh, they found it on him.
The guy, he was crazy. Donnie was ready to light up that school.
Mm.
Obviously, that's a crime. It's, you know, I'm not saying that he shouldn't be punished, quote unquote, but he was unwell.
Yeah, there was something going on, and I think all of those scenarios, and again, going back to Seek to Understand, I'm not saying it's justifiable. I think it's a very horrible thing to do, but you can see how clearly there's been something there. So maybe the young person's been bullied by someone, or maybe something's going on in the family life or whatever. But most of the time, there's been some kind of altercations with students or some kind of like not fitting in, not having friends. And a lot of the times there's been this common sort of theme. And it's like, how long does society need to like understand, or how long do they need to get to that point where they go, you know what, actually, this is a problem. But I think it's kind of like, it's difficult to teach that to young people, because I feel like young people, the whole thing of like the frontal lobes are not developed yet.
Yeah.
So the actual logical decision making is not fully there yet. That's why young people do dumb shit sometimes.
So if you ask a kid what you give, well, look, if you think about like a good example is Justin Bieber. When he got access to his millions, what happened to him? He started ruining himself.
That's what we say. It's good to get rich later than sooner. Because by the time you get to like 30, it's like you live the life, you understand things differently, you understand money differently. So that way the money becomes an asset rather than a liability. Because someone gets rich at like 18, you know, 17, 20, whatever, like young age, it's like they don't know what to do with it. They're not there yet. And plus, think about all the vultures flying around.
Yeah.
Thinking like, yeah, I can benefit off that kid or whatever. It's crazy, man. It's crazy. So just going back to the weak men are more dangerous in society than strong men. I just wanted to say one more thing. So I see it slightly differently, and I'm going to ask you guys I'm going to give an example. Let's say if there's a person A at a workplace, yeah. So there's person A and person B, and let's say person B is always coming in late, like doing madness at work or whatever, just basically moving mad, and then the person A doesn't challenge person B. Is that a weak or a strong man?
Well, I think part of being a man is confrontation, right?
Mm.
I think with men, like, for example, we know, like, let's say you offended me. We know there's a threat of physical violence. You know, we could potentially could scrap, but it's easier for us to squash things, right? Because we can be like, bro, I don't like the way you spoke to man. And you may or may not agree, but I think we could hash it out. And I think confrontation is an inevitable part of life. You cannot avoid confrontation. And I think people that avoid confrontation are dangerous people as well, because they'll let something keep going on and keep building
I say for me, as in my perspective, that would be a weak man. So a person that's not challenging another person or not confronting someone about something. And I think going back to that point of life, I think that creates a worse society, because then we're not actually moving forward, we're not developing, we're not becoming better. Facts. Because we're letting each other down as a man. We're not challenging certain things. And challenges mean growth, right? It's like if someone's being challenged, there's a potential for growth. People might not always take it, but there's a potential there.
Well, a good example is, as I said, my boy, he was smoking every night.
Mm.
Like, it's not confrontational, but I was like, bro, what's up, man? Like, I'm seeing your smoke. And I felt a bit guilty to ask him what was going on, because obviously it's his life, he's smoking what he wants to smoke. But for me, I felt like I would be a bad friend if I didn't say anything to him.
It's not confrontational, but it is challenging him.
Yeah.
It's bringing him out of his norm. He doesn't normally, you wouldn't normally ask him that. Normally, he just goes through the what's known as the rat race. And you pulling his mental out of that for a moment sort of allowed him to open up, man. Yeah, good on you, bro.
Cool.
Facts. Just before we do wrap up, would you have any, let's say someone was going through this on like a deeper level, is there any websites or any numbers that you might know that'll be able to help people out in, well, short term, long term, both?
Yeah, no, I often say to people, my DMs are open, so you can come and speak to me. I'm not a therapist. I only do what I do via lived experience. I'm trying to help other people, but there's charities out there that will help. But I think sometimes, quite often, finding somebody who's going through a similar experience means a lot, you know. Quite often, I think speaking to charities can feel very distant and quite taken away from the issue, which is not always the case. Sometimes that can be the case. But yeah, my DMs are open. There's so many charities out there online. There's so many individuals like me who are telling our stories. But don't hide your pain. Give your pain a voice, I often say to people, you know. Don't allow your pain to stop you. You still deserve to be alive and so much more.
Yeah, I like that. Is there anything you'd like to promote? Anything you're working on?
I've got my TED Talk coming out, actually. So I delivered it on the psychedelic revolution and the idea of how potentially psychedelics could bring about a mental health revolution by giving people a chance at life again. Obviously, there needs to be more research. We need to change drug law and drug policy to be able to do better research into psychedelics and more. Yeah, I've got a lot of exciting stuff coming up. I just released my next article with the Metro about how when I was in the modeling industry, I had quite disordered eating. I wouldn't say an eating disorder because it was undiagnosed, but I'll say definitely disordered eating. I starved myself and more. But I've got a lot more of more exciting work coming out, man. Mm. I'd say to people, just stay tuned. And I'm always trying to push the needle and have very important conversations. And I'm willing to talk to anybody and everybody.
What's the handle so they know how to find you, my guy?
I'm sure you're going to put it in the show notes, but it's at the Sean Flores. So T-H-E-S-H-A-U-N-F-L-O-R-E-S.
You know we're going to put it in the handle. It's going to be there. But guys,
we're gonna slap it in there. Yeah. Nah, and then just the last question, the one we usually close with. You know what's crazy? Today, all the questions kind of flew out, the traditional podcast question that we usually ask, which is cool. Something new, but we're switching up a little bit. But the one question I wanted to ask you, and we always close it with this, and I'm going to know Aladdin right now, but what's your message to the world? What is the message you want to put out there?
The world needs you, even when you think the world doesn't need you. You're not as insignificant as you think you are. You know, you're genuinely somebody that has meaning and purpose. And as I said, through pain, you'll find purpose. On the other side of pain is always some sort of purpose. If you're struggling right now and you want to give up, keep going. If you're in pain, you might as well get a reward from it. It's quite often what I say to people. Tough times don't last. Tough people laugh tough times. And that's something I've really realized.
Wow. That's wow. Beautiful. That's beautiful. I've seen a video of that guy when it says tough times don't last, only tough people.
Yeah, I've seen
tough
it.
And
it
goes, blah, 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 blah.
What does he do? Tough time don't last.
It's only like, tough. Where
was the last bit that he does? Blah, blah, blah.
It's true though. It's
guys,
true.
This has been a fantastic episode of Behind the Scenes.
Stop it, bro. Stop it. Like, do you know what it is? Yeah. I think there's nothing more beautiful than being able to sit down for an hour and a little bit. And actually walking out of the conversation thinking, yo, I've learned something new. I'm going to develop because of this. It's planted a seed. And like you said, conversation is really powerful, man. So
yeah, it's been fantastic.
No, man, I'm honored I'm able to do that, for sure.
Yeah. Fantastic conversation.
Gratitude, man.